Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to a belated Champions League takeaway here on Ranks FC. Taking a look back at what went down on Wednesday. Briefly, I think we're going to shimmy through those games a little bit, but also then to take a little look at the table and what it tells us and a couple of wider trends I want to dig a little bit into as well. My name is Jack Collins, and I will be your host there, and it's only me with you today. Dean's had a little bit of bad news from a family perspective, so he is just dealing with a couple of things. So I'm sending all of the love in the world. I hope you'll join me sending love to Dean and to the Jones family as well. But it's just me, so I'm going to work through a couple of these and give you quick thoughts. I'm going to start with Marseille 0, Liverpool 3. Big win for Liverpool, important win for Liverpool, and one that they deserved as well. Although I think that some of the reactions to it have been perhaps a tad over the top in terms of the effusiveness of their praise. I mean, look, it was an interesting change of shape from Arne Slot. It was more of a sort of either a 4-2-2-2 or a 4-4-2 diamond, depending on what the kind of state of the game was and the certain changes that were made. But I thought it allowed them to do some interesting things. I think we're seeing much more from Frimpong and Kerkez in this shape, both fullbacks able to get forward and make things happen. And Wirtz being in that advanced position can then pull strings. I think that Sly being able to play as a number 10 or a number 8 gives you that ability to just shift the shape of the midfield a little bit so that they can go from a Gravenberch at the base and then Szoboszlai and McAllister in front and Wirtz in the 10, and then Szoboszlai can get forward in points where Liverpool are dominating in the game, kind of change it into that 4-2-2-2, which is, I think, an interesting thing. I also think it gets the best out of Mo Salah in this system, because I thought he was excellent, and with Szoboszlai behind him and the way that he covers that ground, getting into that right-hand side and making sure that Salah has friends over there effectively, people who are around him, one to combine with and two to make sure that there's not kind of overloads, especially with Frimpong getting forward so much. I think it works quite smartly. So Salah, I thought, was excellent across most of this game. And also, I think that Liverpool are just better without Cody Hakpo in the side at the moment. Something we talked about on Patreon and something that's come up with a couple of our Liverpool supporting patrons is the idea that Hakpo this season has become incredibly one-dimensional, that people are able to see what he's going to do. And that doesn't always mean you can stop him, but that shift inside and take a shot, usually into the first defender, has become quite obvious, I think, in different periods of this. It doesn't mean that Cody Hakpo isn't useful. He comes on here and he scores a good goal. And actually, I think that the way he's utilised within this shape might be a little bit different to what we've seen him as an out-and-out winger. So it's something to keep an eye on. But I think that without him starting at the moment, Liverpool look a little bit more balanced and they look like they have a few more strings to their bow. And as I say, the fullbacks really getting up and making things happen. Obviously, Jeremy Frimpong forces the second goal here. I think it's a good thing from a Liverpool perspective. I think that's what you want from fullbacks. When you sign a Kerkez or a Frimpong, you're looking at getting them into areas where they're able to make a difference. Now, that does, I think, leave you a little bit exposed. And not only does that put a lot of onus on Ryan Gravenberch in the middle of the park to sort of drop in and split the centre-backs and become a three at times, but also it means that you need to find a rotation piece for him, because he's not going to be able to do that for 90 minutes in every game as you continue to compete across multiple competitions. And I think that we know that Arne Slot at this point doesn't trust Wataru Endo. I think that Liverpool do need to find someone who's going to be able to make that happen. Now, whether that's another centre-back who's comfortable stepping out and playing as defensive midfielder, which feels a little bit unicorn-y for a January transfer window, or whether that's just a defensive midfielder in there who's going to be able to help allay the situation, I don't know what that looks like. And I don't know what Liverpool's kind of transfer policy is going to be in this January window, especially with the news breaking on Friday morning that Andy Robertson is potentially going to be allowed to leave. They look paper thin as far as I'm concerned. Maybe Stefan Bajcetic is going to come back into the picture, but considering we haven't seen him for like 18 months, I don't think we can rely on something like that happening. So I do think it's going to be intriguing if this is a system that Liverpool persist with if they're going to be looking at bringing someone in there to be able to maybe rotate and also at times push Gravenberch forward, because he remains, I think, the best ball carrier here. And you want him to be able to turn and go at times without leaving yourselves incredibly exposed, especially given the fact that the Liverpool are able to kind of burst through the midfield and make things happen. That was such a key element for them in last year's, well, Premier League winning title. I mean, look, it's a great free kick from Szoboszlai. Whether this is planned or whether Marseille are just so wary of his over-the-wall threat, I don't know. But I think it's really smart stuff either way. He spots the gap. He knows that this is a Marseille team who are going to be aware of his ability to lift the ball over a wall and into the top corner. And he just strokes the ball home. That said, I don't think Geronimo Rui covers himself in glory here or over the course of this game. I wasn't completely sold on him at Villarreal, and I still remain not completely sold on him. And look, this was an improvement from Liverpool. They 100% deserve to win. I don't think that there's any question about that, but I still think they're giving up way too many chances. This game could have ended like 9-5, which is fun. Like, don't get me wrong, I very much enjoyed watching it, but I think that if you're giving up that many chances on a different day against a different side who perhaps are a little bit sharper in the attacking third, or Alisson isn't on the form that he was on this one, I think you might end up getting punished as well. So plenty to like about Liverpool's shift, plenty to like about them going to the Velodrome, which is a difficult place to go, and putting Marseille to the sword in this kind of fashion. I am still a little bit worried about the fact that they are giving up this many chances from a defensive perspective. But if you were going to offer Liverpool fans a 3-0 win in Marseille to kind of just get everyone to breathe a little bit, I think they would have taken that hands down. And to see Salah back in and being, you know, incredibly useful within this system, yes, he perhaps should do better when he runs through on goal, but I think that his finishing and his ability to finish is going to be the least of my concerns. It's about how it all links together. And I thought that he linked up well, and some good things happened for Liverpool from an attacking standpoint in this game. So plenty to be positive about. I think that it's going to be very interesting to see if there's moves made from Liverpool at the end of this transfer market, just to be able to shore up a couple of positions, which are going to be really, really crucial if they are going to continue to utilize a formation like this. Let's go over to Chelsea, who won 1-0 against Paphos. And it's a strange one, this. Like, the bridge was very, very flat. Obviously, protests continue, and this did feel like a bit like a Conference League game from last season, I thought. And I can understand that, right? Like, obviously, I was talking to a friend of mine, Chelsea fan, last night, and he was explaining how the tickets for the group stage all came in a bundle. So if you wanted a ticket for Barcelona or Ajax, you had to buy your ticket for Paphos at the same time. So there's always going to be an element of that. And there are going to be people that, you know, go to those big games and maybe look at this one and think, yeah, I might give that one a miss, or I might be busy, or whatever that happens. It's January, right? I'm not really criticizing, but I do think it's kind of one of those ones where the ground and the atmosphere reflected it. And look, you kind of felt that with the goal. Now, Chelsea were a bit unlucky, I thought, in the early goal being ruled out. That push, or decision of a push on Enzo Fernandez, is very, very harsh. I have no idea how that wasn't looked at. And maybe it's a very, very different game if Chelsea score an opening goal. But look, Paphos defended really well. They sat in and they frustrated Chelsea. There are question marks over the ability to break down a block like this, especially with a couple of key players missing. But it's a win, right? Like, and it's a win that keeps Chelsea in contention. I do wonder if, when we're kind of looking back at this after match week 8, if the fact that they weren't able to run up the goal difference here with everyone so tight on a number of points is going to be something that they look back at. Because if they sneak a win, let's say, against Napoli next week, and they're in contention for that automatic spot and they miss out on goal difference, is this going to be the game that you look back at as a Chelsea fan and think, oh, we should have run up the scoreboard there? That's easier said than done, right? But equally, you have to look at it and say that the calibre of these two teams, especially with David Luiz missing for Paphos, who's kind of been the talisman in the defence, they were very impressive without him, but I think you have to find a way if you're Chelsea. And look, Liam Delap, I think, is really, really struggling. And the fact that his best moment was a dummy rather than a touch, I think, speaks quite a lot about his effect on this game. Liam Rossini has won 3 of his first 4 games in charge at Chelsea. And in the other one, they lost narrowly on paper to the best team in England right now. But I don't think anybody's completely convinced. They were second best against Brentford at the weekend, and they struggled to break down, you know, a very defensive Paphos here. Look, I'm not really rushing to judgment, Somrazenia. Like, he's missing a number of key players. It's going to take time to get through to this group. It remains very much a work in progress for the time being. That's okay. Like, it's going to take time for him to implement his methods. And if the players are buying in to what Limrazenia is doing, it doesn't really matter if the wider football world is seeing him as a meme, right? Like, that's kind of fine. If you look at it in the grander context, if this player's response to a manager like this, who is younger, who is going to be looking at it from a slightly different perspective, then I think that that's probably a win. And the fact that it took so long, the fact it felt like relief when Chelsea scored as opposed to joy is something. But Estevao coming on at halftime and making a difference, really livening up Chelsea and livening up this game, he's a little bit unlucky not to find himself on the score sheet himself. Like, there are signs that Liam Rosenia is starting to understand what he needs to do. Now, he is limited at the moment in terms of certain players being, you know, struck down with a viral infection, other players being injured, and he's kind of tweaking the team to work out exactly what the elements of it that are working for him. And it's been different in different games, right? There's been games where Alejandro Garnacho has looked really good in spells. In this game, he was incredibly frustrating and really, really, really should have done better instead of running down dark alleys over and over again. But Pedro Neto, who's been good in flashes this season, wasn't impressive here. Delap, as we say, really struggled, I think, to have an impact on this game, and it was no great surprise that João Pedro came on for him to try and kind of knit things together as opposed to try and batter down the door. So it just feels a little bit like Chelsea are trying to work it out. The Rosenia is trying to work it out with one hand tied a little bit behind his back right now. Ultimately, Chelsea get the win and they get the job done. I don't think that, you know, bar that Zaha shot, which was, you know, deflected onto the post, I don't think Paphos made the keeper work across the entirety of the rest of the game. And that tells you the control that Chelsea had. The difference is, can you get that control and turn it into creating a glut of goal-scoring opportunities? Because it felt to me like Chelsea were looking at pot shots, were looking at crosses into the box that were slightly aimless at times, and actually creating chances and building patterns of play that are going to break down teams who are stubborn. This is not the only team that Chelsea are going to face this season who sit in and try to be stubborn against them. And they're going to have to find ways to win those games. And at the moment, it just feels like that creative spark is missing a little bit with this team. Now, again, we'll give the benefit of the doubt in the same way we will with a bunch of managers, you know, who have just been appointed and who are going to have to take time to kind of impose what they want to do from a stylistic perspective onto their team. But at the moment, I remain pretty unconvinced with Chelsea. Even if they got the job done here, they go to Naples and they would come up against a Napoli team now who are fighting for their own lives, who a loss would eliminate from the tournament in truth. And they come up against a former manager in Conte and potentially Lukaku. There's a lot of drama and narrative surrounding that game. I actually think it might play into Chelsea's hands a little bit more because Napoli won't sit in like this. This is it's not going to be the same kind of game. And whether that opens up opportunities for Chelsea to try and be more expansive and find those holes, we'll see. But ultimately, as much as it wasn't particularly pretty, wasn't particularly joyful, and the atmosphere around it wasn't particularly good, Chelsea have kept themselves in contention. And I suppose that's the element of this that you look at and think, you know what, with it all said and done, job done. Right, Barcelona went to Prague to play Slavia, and I think everyone was expecting them to win. I'm not sure everyone was expecting them to win 4-2 in a game this chaotic. And look, let's start by saying that I think Barcelona is still the most watchable big side in Europe at the moment. And partly that is because they remain deeply flawed. Like, it is wild to consider that they were even considering selling Fermín López to Chelsea at the start of this season. He's such a useful footballer. He scores two wonderful goals here. And at the moment, he's keeping an out-of-form Dani Olmo out of this team. Dani Olmo comes off the bench and he scores a really good goal to put Barcelona back, you know, in the lead, which is a lead that they do not relinquish. Robert Lewandowski scoring his first Champions League goal of the season after scoring an own goal earlier in the game. I don't know if that counts. Do you think they should cancel each other out? You score an own goal, so you are a minus one for the season. You have to go back to zero before you can go onwards. But I think that's 15 straight seasons in which Robert Lewandowski has scored in the Champions League. His career is just a study in consistency and excellence. And it really, really is impressive. But Barcelona look very, very susceptible from set pieces. And obviously both goals here come from Herles flicks from Slavia Prague corners. The first one bundled in at the back stick, the second one hits Lewandowski and goes in. There's not much they can do about it. That's to go back to 2-2. But It does kind of strike me that it feels like teams are going to be able to prey on those weaknesses in the same way that Inter did, right, in the semi-finals. I think this Barcelona side is slightly weaker than the team that was there last season. And look, people will have their own opinions on whether they think that's true or not. But I think that just in terms of the balance of the side, they feel slightly more off. Last year, there were holes, but it felt like they were playing on those holes as kind of an incentive for teams to come at them, and then they would score a heap of goals. They're still scoring and a very, very good click. But you look at it this year and it feels a bit more chaotic in terms of the way they're defending. It's not that, you know, they're leaving that space and going, come on then, we're inviting you into it, as they were maybe earlier on in this season. It feels now like teams are just finding ways to get through this Barcelona. And it does make their games incredibly interesting, incredibly watchable, incredibly entertaining. So I'm not really complaining. I might be if I was a Barcelona fan. But I do feel like when you look at Barcelona, there is this sense that they are a sort of like a 90s throwback in some ways, in that they're like, we're just going to outscore you. And that hasn't really changed in the tenure that Hansi Flick's been at the helm of Barcelona. It makes them a bit of a strange watch because you're not quite sure where the next error is going to come from. And look, if you were going to sign a player for Barcelona in this transfer window, it would be a left centre back, right? Someone like a Pau Torres, who's able to come in there not only with the technical ability, but also maybe just slow it down and slot in next to Pau Cabarsi. We saw the Gerard Martin experiment kind of come in at centre back, and he did well for a couple of games. It now feels like Flick has moved him back into the rotation, as apart from that being his first choice starting 11 in the same way. Cancelo comes back in and on loan. And does that mean that Jules Koundé comes into the centre-back rotation? Does that mean that there are going to be changes in a number of different ways to try and make it all stick? I don't know yet, but I find them intriguing. And I think that their ceiling is still incredibly high because of the way that they are able to break teams down. It's almost like the counterpunch to what we were talking about with Chelsea there, right? Like, I feel like whoever you are, Barcelona are going to find a way to score against you. The problem is that they are also probably going to find a way to concede against you. And the run of conceding goals in games goes on and on and on. How long does that last? The big story, I suppose, is that Pedri picks up an injury. He's out for a month. And that's a big, big blow, given his ability to control games. And if you think about the games that Pedri has missed in the Champions League this season, he misses the big defeat to Chelsea. And he misses that really chaotic game against Club Brugge that ended 3-3. And whilst there was obviously external circumstances in Araujo getting sent off in the Chelsea game that maybe took it out of Barcelona's control a little bit more, it's notable that both of those games were even more helter-skelter than Barcelona games tend to be. That it feels like there is no control without Pedri in there. And that's not to talk down the rest of Barcelona's midfield. We know that there is a lot of very talented footballers in here, that Frankie de Jong has cemented his spot after so many years of questions where he fitted and whether he was going to be sold, etc. He feels like a very, very key part of how this Barcelona operate. But without Pedri, I think that these games become far, far looser. And in an era where Barcelona are pretty loose anyway, it potentially does put them the cat amongst the pigeons for them a little bit. So Barcelona are going to be fine. They're going to be in the knockout stages of this competition. I'm not hugely worried about their ability to score goals and make things happen. And again, you tune in every time they play because it's so fun and so chaotic. But I do wonder a little bit if there is a sense that, especially with Pedri out, they might have to just find another way to find a little bit more control in the weeks going forward. And seeing how Flick deals with that is going to be very, very interesting, I think. Right, we'll take a little break there. When we come back, a load more games to rattle through before we get into a little bit more of the deep dive stuff. Stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC. It's Jack Collins with you. We're about to rattle through some games. Let's get into it. Juve 2, Benfica 0. Juventus are still quite a hard side to pin down, I think. And I'm still not exactly sure what Spalletti is trying to do. But there are some good signs. I know they lost to Cagliari at the weekend. But I think that over the last couple of weeks, we've seen positive signs from a Juventus perspective. And one of them is that Jonathan David is getting much, much better. His work off off the ball, his interplay, his link-up were key to both of Juventus' goals here. And again, bringing on Chico Conceição proved to be a difference maker at half-time. He's the catalyst for a much-improved second-half performance. That pushed McKennie inside. He worked really nicely off the striker, just bombing about, and is rewarded with his third Champions League goal of the season. He's Juve's joint top goal scorer in the Champions League with Dusan Vlahovic. And I think it probably is only a matter of time before we see Weston McKennie sign a new contract. But his versatility has been key. He was a little bit wasted, I thought, out on the right-hand side of the first half. But as soon as he came inside, that link-up, that interplay, and actually making sure that he was the one getting in there and leading the press, I thought was very, very important for the way that Juve kind of took control of this game in the second half. Brilliant from Locatelli as well, I thought. He was absolutely everywhere in a two-man midfield. And look, it keeps Juve's hopes alive of securing an automatic spot. Now, I think it's going to be very, very difficult for them to do so. That's a theme that's going to come up again, but it keeps their hopes alive. And I think that we are seeing that return to a four at the back, the moves from Spalletti to try and bring this under control, and his substitutions, which did make a huge difference to this, I think are very, very impressive. Now, it wasn't all one-way traffic, and there was a penalty for Benfica, which was inexplicably spooned by Pavlovic, and I have no idea what he's trying to do. You often feel sorry for a penalty player who's missed a penalty. This wasn't one of those occasions. I have no idea what he was trying to do. And look, Benfica had their moments, but this felt like a very, very good second-half performance in particular from Juventus, and they took the game to Benfica in that second half, ended up with the two goals that they deserve, Kefren Turam getting the other one as well, and actually starting to improve his output in that kind of area as well, getting further forward, allowing Locatelli to man the base of that midfield, bombing forward and joining the attack as Juve started to throw players forwards. And, you know, shout out to Lloyd Kelly as well. Another good game, I thought, from him, and a couple of really, really important blocks as Benfica tried to counter. So a good win for Juve and a good performance, especially in the second half, to go with it. Atalanta 2, Athletic Club 3. Great game of football for the neutral. Again, quite a bizarre one to analyse. Athletic had the first chance in this game. It fell to Grotheta, who keeps scoring away from home but can't score at home for whatever reason. But he missed it, and then Atalanta took full control of this first half. They were very fairly 1-0 up at the break. It maybe could have been more. They hit the post, a couple of really good saves as well. But the Basques were sort of fighting for their lives, and they did get the equaliser. That really changed the momentum of the game. And from that moment, they took it to their hosts, roared back with three goals in a row. That first goal was remarkably simple, I thought. One sort of cut a long ball over the top, Grotheta combining with Robert Navarro to go clear and score. And Navarro was excellent. He set up the second goal as well and capped the performance with a third. Lovely through ball from Ojan Sanser. And in the absence of the Williams brothers, he was the one that ended up changing this game and dictating Athletic's route back into the competition, because it looked like they were done and dusted. Atalanta did find a late goal to make it interesting, but Athletic hang on, keep their destiny in their own hands. It kind of puts a real dent in Atalanta's hopes of making the top eight and missing out on those playoffs, but keeps Athletic's playoff hopes alive. So an interesting game, a really, really good watch, and one that Athletic, out of a bit of mire of being all over the place recently, ended up finding solutions in strange places and making it happen. But Navarro and Grotheta together and combining, I thought, was an interesting thing that we might see Ernesto Valverde lean on a little bit more over the next couple of weeks. Some big games coming up for them. They've got the derby against Real Sociedad, and then obviously again in the Champions League next week, we're going to see kind of what the source looks like and whether they have that ability to push themselves into the knockout stages. Talking of teams who are going to be in the playoffs, shout out to Karabakh. They won 3-2 against Eintracht Frankfurt. They've been a brilliant story in this season's Champions League. They really impressed me in the Europa last time out. I thought that they were front-footed. They're a difficult team to beat, especially at home. They are willing to kind of take risks and attack. And yeah, okay, they concede a fair few goals, but so do Eintracht, and they took full advantage. Turns out sacking Dino Topmöller hasn't immediately fixed all of Eintracht's defensive issues, which is unsurprising in some ways. Not that it was the wrong decision. I talked about this a fair bit on the Patreon earlier on in the week. Not that it was the wrong decision to sack him, because you can't have the defensive record that they had. They were joint worst in the Bundesliga with Heidenheim. And considering the fact that it is going to be a bit of a scrap to get those European places in the Bundesliga, it's very, very concertinaed at the moment. Like, it did feel like they probably needed to make a change with the amount of goals they were conceding. And, you know, we saw that equaliser against Werder Bremen, not really celebrated. And I think I kind of told you everything you needed to know about the fact that Eintracht were not happy with what was going on. And I do think it's going to be very interesting to see what Eintracht do now in terms of a managerial appointment. They are eliminated from the Champions League, whilst Karabag should be okay to make a playoff spot no matter what happens at Anfield next week. They've got 10 points. I think that will be enough. But in terms of Eintracht, what they do now from a managerial perspective, with that concertina going on, who they appoint to try and push themselves back in, I think it's too good an opportunity to pass up. And there's clearly some incredibly talented attacking players here. Chan Azun scoring the first goal. He's having a good season and a nice little breakout campaign. So I think it's going to be one to keep an eye on over the next couple of weeks to see what Eintracht do here and what kind of direction they go with the manager. Do they bring in a more defensively minded coach to try and shore things up at the back? Or do they look to someone who's going to find that balance and make sure that this attack isn't stifled, because it has been such a high point of their season as well? Final word goes to Belal Mustafazadeh, who became the first Azerbaijani player to score in the competition with the last kick of this game, which obviously took all 3 points for Frankfurt. It was unbelievable scenes in Baku, a fitting moment as well. There, it was an Azeri player that ended up scoring that goal and the first one to do so. So shout out to Karabag. They've been a whole lot of fun, and people are not going to want to travel to Baku, no matter where they end up in those playoff places. They've been a real breath of fresh air, so good on them. And it's been a really, really enjoyable campaign to watch, whatever happens, as I say, at Anfield. Okay, let's quickly go to Turkey. Galatasaray 1, Atletico Madrid 1. I don't have loads to say about Gala here, apart from I didn't think they were particularly good. And it was a bit of a strange game, because at times in the first half, it looked like Atleti were going to run away with it. But they're really, really, really profligate at the moment. They'd take an early lead, and although they were unlucky to concede from an own goal from Marcus Llorente to level things up, Atleti really, really dominated the first hour of the game in terms of the way that they got into dangerous areas. But it just feels like at the moment things aren't falling. Now, Julian Alvarez is having a bit of a goal drought. Sorloth wasn't picked out enough, and he scored 4 of Atleti's 5 goals, I think, coming into this game in 2026. It feels like he's the kind of one route to goal. And look, if Alvarez is going through a bit of a barren spell, that's okay. He's not been as good this year as he was last year. I don't think anyone's going to argue with that. But it just doesn't feel to me that there's lots of things going on, in that the substitutions didn't really work from Simeone, and the threat faded because Alvarez is out of form. Griezmann feels like a fading force, and it breaks my heart to say that. I love Antoine Griezmann. Thiago Almada has really struggled for rhythm, and Bayern is just not quite at it right now. And with all of that said, like, Atleti looked pretty blunt in the final third. It felt like crosses into Sorlot were the only way they were going to find joy in certain aspects of this game. And then they take Sorlot off. And look, a lot of the crosses weren't finding him. I think that's probably fair to say. But they keep swinging crosses in for Baena and Griezmann. And those two are not going to win. Neither of them over 5'9". You know, they weren't able to get any sort of foothold from an aerial perspective. So if you're going to make those changes, you've got to change up the style of play as well. And it didn't feel like Atleti were able to do that. Now, there were some good things. I thought that Mark Pubil did a really good job handling Osimhen, especially considering he was on a yellow card for a lot of the game. And Pablo Barrios, again, absolutely brilliant in the middle of the park. Him and Koke look like the kind of first choice partnership, which is fine. But Koke cannot do 90 minutes 3 times a week at this point. Like, it just looks like his legs kind of gave way in this game. He wasn't the usual controlling force that we've seen over the course of this season with his incredible kind of renaissance. And so Koke goes off and Barrios goes off. Lenormand comes back on, and he did okay from a defensive perspective. They shuffled it around. Puba went out to right back. Llorente came in to the center of the park. But it just felt like they lost the control of the game at that point. And to be honest, they were a little bit lucky. A brilliant Jan Oblak save late on from Gabriel Sara, and Llorente does well, actually, despite scoring the own goal, to clear the ball away at that moment to make sure that Atleti leave Galatasaray with a point. But you kind of look at it and think, ooh, you are struggling to impact games in different ways. And, you know, Nico Gonzalez came on. I'm not sure where he fits within this team. Almada looks a little bit lost playing off the left-hand side. Baena feels like the rhythm has gone from those injuries earlier in the season. And the player that we saw at Villarreal last campaign doesn't feel like the same one that we're seeing at Atleti at the moment. So it's a Bit of a strange situation. Again, Atleti have hope of finishing in the top eight. They need to win and hope a couple of other results, you know, go their way. They need to beat Bodo Glimt and they need to probably run up a scoreline at the Metropolitano. But they also need three or four teams above them to not win their games. Now, not impossible, but it feels like they're relying on others and they didn't need to be there if they'd been able to take their chances in this one. So it's going to be interesting to see if there's any movement in the transfer market now that they've let Raspadori go. One to keep an eye on in terms of how they might change things up in the final third, but just doesn't feel like Atleti are at the races right now from an attacking perspective. And they need to sort that out pretty quickly or they're not going to get much further than, you know, the quarterfinals at the very most of this competition. Okay, let's go to Bayern Munich. We're going to talk about them a little bit later on in a bit more depth. They won 2-0 against Union Saint-Gilloise. I was a bit surprised this scoreline didn't end up being more ruthless. It was always going to be a tough ask to catch Arsenal for Bayern, but they could have upped the pressure if they'd run up the scoreboard here. They were a little bit laissez-faire in attack. Kane missed a penalty. Elise missed a sitter. It felt quite unlike Bayern over the course of this season. And look, still, they're pretty much guaranteed second spot. Credit to USG, who battled hard throughout what was a difficult visit to Bavaria. And the lineup felt a little bit weird to me. I'm still quite unconvinced by Rafael Guerreiro playing at right back. Tom Biskov played at left back. And then the midfield was Pavlovic and Kimmich. I kind of just assume when you see that team on paper that Kimmich was going to be playing at right back, that Guerreiro was going to be playing at left back, and it was going to be Biskov and Pavlovic in the middle of the park. Biskov didn't do a great job at left back. Guerreiro didn't do a great job at right back. And it just meant that there were opportunities for USG. It felt like areas that they targeted. And whilst they didn't score, they did find some joy. I don't think that's going to work going forward in the Champions League. Now, I'm sure that, you know, Bayern fans will turn around and be like, well, that's clearly not the first choice defence. And also, we ended this game with 10 men after Kim was sent off with 25 minutes to go or so. And all of that is true. I just feel like if you were looking at this, and I don't know what the drill with Joshua Kimmich is right now, but it just feels like he... In a normal lineup here, he plays at right back because there aren't many options for Bayern in that area at the moment. And Guerreiro over there just clearly isn't working in the same way that it does when he's at left back or in centre midfield, where he's actually been more impressive than I've thought at times, you know, over the course of the last couple of years. If it is Kimmich being like, no, I only play in central midfield, I think Bayern are a little bit light in that area and might need to look to recruit. Because I don't think this will work against teams who are bigger and better than USG, with all the respect in the world. So nothing to kind of worry about for Bayern in terms of this game, this score. Yes, they should have scored a couple more and they could have, you know, put a little bit more pressure on Arsenal. They're probably going to finish in the top two. And that's fine because one and two are paired together and it means that they will get those home games all the way to the final if they, you know, maintain their winning record. But there are a couple of signs of things that aren't quite working as well in the defensive end of things as there are in the attacking third. And look, Michael Olise remains a joy to watch. Harry Kane still scores a brace here, even though he misses a penalty. It's not end of days and there's nothing hugely to worry about with Bayern. But I do think there's just a couple of tweaks that probably need to happen if they're just to make this a little bit more comfortable for themselves. And that leads us to Newcastle United, who won 3-0 against PSV. A big and important win for Newcastle. Also a game that really suited them. And PSV were kind of the masters of their own downfall in so many ways. The goals in the first half, both mistakes from PSV and exceptional pressing from Newcastle. Both things could be true at the same time. And forcing errors and turnovers like this is a good thing, right, from a Newcastle perspective. With that said, I still have major concerns about Newcastle's chance creation when they do have the ball. There is only so much that running like mad will get you against teams who are better than PSV. And Bruno coming off will add to some of those concerns. We don't still know exactly what the extent of that injury is, but that's not good news. Probably Newcastle's most important footballer and someone who can find those moments of magic to open up a team. That said, I thought it was really, really lovely to see Lewis Miley wearing the armband on a Champions League night in front of the Gallagher. That will mean a lot to a lot of people. And in a place where homegrown talent and local heroes mean so much to the populace, to see him with the armband on at the end of the game, like beaming after a win, kind of really did sort of well, stirred the soul a little bit, right? Like, I'm not going to suggest that a tear came out, but I can imagine it might well have done for some of the Geordies in the Gallagher and some of the people who, you know, are thick and thin through this club. So lovely for Lewis Miley. I'm going to take a break there, but I want to dig a little bit more into Champions League versus Premier League for Newcastle and Spurs after the break. So it's not the end of the Newcastle conversation, but I think that it's interesting to discuss them in a slightly more general sense as to what this league table means, but it doesn't take away from a really good win and the fact that Newcastle have now won their last three games in the Champions League at home. I think 8-0 on aggregate. No one has scored bar Barcelona at St James's Park over the course of this campaign, which is a really, really good sign. And there are some nice things for Eddie Howe to work with. I'm just intrigued as to what this looks like compared to their Premier League form, and I want to dig into that a little bit more deeper in part three. So make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC. I'm Jack Collins. In this final part, I just want to take a look at the table and a couple of trends and things that have been going on that I think are interesting and maybe worth just considering ahead of next week. And look, someone said to me earlier this week, they said, Arsenal and Bayern are the two teams who are top of the Champions League table. Are they the two best teams in Europe? And therefore, is this a good indication of where we are and where we've got to over the course of this season so far? And I thought it was an interesting question because I think that Arsenal and Bayern are the two best teams in Europe. Right, like I think that over the course of the season so far, that's what we've seen in terms of performances, in terms of these teams turning up week in, week out and making it happen, both from a domestic perspective and from a European perspective. But is that where the table kind of really ends being useful? Because you look at the chasing pack, so the current other teams in the top eight, therefore going through automatically and missing the playoffs, are Real Madrid in third, Liverpool in fourth, Tottenham in fifth, PSG in sixth, Newcastle in seventh, Chelsea in eighth. And just outside them, we have Barcelona, Sporting, City, Atleti, Atlanta and Inter. Fine, who are all kind of within that chasing pack. And between Tottenham in fifth and Juventus in 15th, you have 2 points. Right. So it's quite interesting to see it in terms of how close that has become. And what that means is that match day eight is going to be very, very interesting in terms of who nicks those final places, as well as that battle in that bottom bit where PSV are on 8 points in 22nd and the Ajax in 32nd are on 6 points. So 2 points separate them as well. And that's a battle to just stay alive in the competition. Never mind skip some rounds. And look, there have been people who have talked about this format and saying that it's not as interesting. And look, that's a choice that you have to make on a personal level, right? Like I quite like the new format in certain elements. I don't think it's perfect, but I do think that the league table style has added some interesting caveats and interesting facets to the Champions League. Now, is it as dramatic on the final day as it was on the final day of the group stages? No, probably not. But I think the moving and shaking does keep things interesting. And the fact that there is reward at the end of it, rather than just 16 teams going through and that being that, I think probably is a good thing for the competition as a whole. But what's really interesting, I think, about the way that this has shaken out is that that group of teams, Real Madrid, Liverpool, Tottenham, PSG, Newcastle, all the way down. I don't think anyone is legitimately saying to you, least of all Tottenham fans, that Tottenham are the fifth best team in Europe so far this season. But they've been really good in the Champions League. And I think equally a Newcastle fan would turn around and be like, well, look at our league position and yet we're seventh in the Champions League. How is that all kind of shaking out? And the way that the Premier League clubs are fanned here at the top of the table. So Arsenal in first, there's six Premier League clubs in the Champions League this year. Arsenal, top of the pile, perfect record, been absolutely phenomenal, fine. Liverpool in fourth, Tottenham in fifth, Newcastle in seventh, Chelsea in eighth, and Man City in 11th. So no one lower than 11th. If you look at the spread across different leagues, so Bayern in second, for example, and then the Bundesliga's current lowest entrant, Eintracht Frankfurt, 33rd, eliminated from the competition. We talk about Spain, Real Madrid in third. La Liga's bottom club in the competition is Villarreal, who are 35th with 1 point, and who have been pretty dreadful across the entirety of this tournament. Now, there's a conversation at some point to be had about the fact that Villarreal have been so good domestically this season and just haven't been able to compete in the Champions League on the same footing whatsoever. And maybe that's depth. But you think about all the other, you know, big leagues in Europe, there is a representative from the Bundesliga, from La Liga. There is a representative from Serie A currently outside of the playoff places in Napoli, who are Serie A reigning champions, right? You look at the teams down there and Benfica and Ajax, and look, yeah, Ajax having a dreadful season, but there are some big names down here as well from a variety of different leagues. The only one that interestingly doesn't is obviously Ligue 1, but Ligue 1's lowest side are Monaco, who are one, in danger of elimination, and two, there's only three teams. So it makes it a little bit more difficult to judge. And in Serie A, there's no teams in the top eight, but you do have Atalanta, Inter and Juventus all sitting there, you know, in 13th, 14th and 15th, and with, you know, eyes on getting to those automatic spots on the final match day. But why has there been such a dominance from a Premier League perspective? Now, I'm not going to go into the money in too much detail because, one, it's quite boring to talk about money in the same way. And two, you've heard me go down this diatribe before, that the Premier League is financially superpowered to the point where only the biggest clubs in the world are able to compete with it. And, you know, your Real Madrid's, your Barcelona's, your PSG's, your Bayern's. Like, is anybody else in the same financial category as the Premier League sides? Not really. You know, and you kind of can look at that from Newcastle just going and buying Malik Chow from Milan, who was, you know, excellent there and has been excellent for Newcastle. We've looked at this in the Premier League's kind of financial muscle all the way down the league in different episodes. But that creates a couple of different things. One, the fact that there's six English teams in the Champions League means that that's to do with the coefficient, right? And all of those different aspects, and the fact that, you know, there were winners from the Europa League in the competition, fine. But what that means with the structure of the way that the draw happens is that because the Premier League teams can't draw each other, and because they're all ranked highly within the coefficients, that means that effectively their strength of schedule becomes easier. Now, that isn't always the case, and it doesn't mean that you can't have a difficult draw. I think Chelsea had a relatively difficult draw in this season's Champions League, but it does mean that the chances of you coming up against a variety of different giants is smaller, and it does give you a little bit extra in terms of the strength of schedule, which isn't necessarily a thing in the same way it is in, like, the college football playoffs, sure, but it does mean that you get a different kind of group of games to perhaps that Dortmund might get, just for example. And the other thing is that because the Champions League has a lot of teams in there who are dominant within their own domestic, you know, circumstances, and this isn't always the case, but who are dominant in a way that, like, a PSV are, for example. Let's just take them as an example. And actually, it rolls back into the Newcastle game, which is quite nice because it's something I wanted to discuss. But PSV are so dominant in the Eredivisie, right? They're absolutely flying clear at the top of the table. They are going to win the league. And Peter Bosz is able there to play this really fun, expansive style of football, which has been a joy to behold. And it's put them 16 points clear of Feyenoord at the top of the table. Then they come to Newcastle and they try to play in that manner. And Newcastle, given the fact that they are physically so dominant, are able to pick them off. And you look at the press in that game and you look at the fact that Anthony Gordon and Johan Wissa are leading that to such an incredible, emphatic degree. And they turn PSV over twice in 20 minutes and the game's pretty much done from that aspect. And look, that's a perfectly fine, reasonable way to score goals. This isn't me talking down about Newcastle. But it's a bit different to take as a counterexample Paphos playing Chelsea, who sit in really, really deep, and they try to make it as hard as possible, as you'd imagine, as a smaller side, for them to be broken down. PSV were never going to come to Newcastle and play like that, in the same way that Dortmund were never going to come to Tottenham and try to just shut the game down in any capacity, and they end up being picked off by Tottenham in what I said on Tuesday was one of the best performances that we've seen from Spurs under Thomas Frank. And I wonder if there is an element of, not just in terms of squad building and the ability to bring players in and spend more money than almost anyone else, but also in terms of the physicality of the Premier League, that there is an advantage here that's being played out across the course of the Champions League this season. We're seeing Spurs put in their best performances of this campaign in the Champions League because teams are more likely to open up against them and they're able to take advantage of that. That they're able to come up against players who have been good in the Bundesliga. Look, I don't think this is a vintage Dortmund season by any stretch of the imagination, but they are second in the Bundesliga and they've picked up a bit of a gap over third, which at the moment is Hoffenheim. But that's to do with, you know, the differing strengths within that competition. I think that if you're looking at this and saying, okay, this is proof that the Premier League is dominant, I think you're probably right in terms of they are dominant in this kind of setting when they can't play against each other, and the competition that they are able to play against is at a significant financial and physical disadvantage when you're playing at them. And part of that is the rest of the Premier League has got a lot stronger, and therefore there are games here where you're coming up against opposition who, one, don't know you very well, which is a good thing for certain one-dimensional players, right? Like, if you have one really good aspect to your game, you are much more likely to get joy out of that aspect. If you're coming up against players that don't play you week in, week out, then you are against players who know you very, very well and know what you're going to try to do. And I think we've seen that play out in certain circumstances over the course of this Champions League. But also, because you are being pushed from that physical perspective, these games probably do feel a little bit easier from an actual physical standpoint than perhaps coming up against an Iraola press-heavy Bournemouth. You know, do you come up against a PSV who want to keep the ball and knock it about and play nice football? And you think, okay, that's nice. Now, that isn't a hard and fast rule. We saw PSV go to Anfield and dismantle Liverpool in some manner, right? Like, we were able to, you can see that when it all clicks and when it works, there are things in it. But Liverpool aren't as physical a side as Newcastle, and they weren't able to put PSV under the same kind of pressure. And obviously, therefore, there is an element of the way that you are stylistically built can help you in certain circumstances and not help you in others. And as I said, I'm slightly more concerned about Newcastle's chance creation from open play than I am about Liverpool's. That doesn't mean that every game is going to work out for them in exactly the same way, but it does mean that overall, I think that there is an advantage being held. Now, the counter to this is that what we do see is there is not a Premier League domination of the Champions League in terms of winners, in terms of teams getting to the final. Oh, we haven't seen that in the last couple of years, despite this increased spending. And that probably goes to the other side of this, the yin yang of it in some ways, which is that if you are being pushed week in, week out, and, you know, we talked about this with Arsenal and the idea of them winning it all. If you are being pushed week in, week out in every single competition, as opposed to Bayern, who already, as far as I'm concerned, kind of have the Bundesliga season signed up and kind of done and dusted, they will win the league from this position. I would be absolutely stunned. I was going to say I'll stop podcasting, but then I would be literally screwed. So I'm not going to do that. But like, I would be absolutely astonished, and I think most people would, if Bayern didn't win the league from this position of power, especially with this kind of chaotic struggle going on beneath them. Now, that doesn't mean that the Bundesliga isn't incredibly interesting, right? There's incredible scraps across the league, especially for those European places, and the fact that there are so many teams competing for them, that it means that you can write the league off. That's not what I'm getting at here. It just means that they have been able to get above it and almost kind of see it out. Now, what that means for them playing in the Champions League, which is obviously a tournament they would love to get their hands back on, right, when it comes to April and they are pretty much sewed up in the league and they're able to rotate and rest in a way that Arsenal probably can't, in that they're going for their first Premier League title in, you know, God knows how long. That maybe then comes into play in a different manner, in that at that point, does it start to hinder you? Are there teams here who we're seeing not play as well as we think they can? Let's take PSG, for example, who are six, but I don't think have been anywhere near as good as what we saw in the back 6 months of last season. Well, they played in the Club World Cup. And off the back of that, they've had a lot of games. We're seeing something similar with Chelsea, I think, in particular, that there is this tiredness. And Man City, you know, something we talked about on Tuesday, that there is this tiredness starting to set in for some of these clubs who did go all the way or close to all the way in that tournament and put a lot into it, and therefore were given reduced pre-seasons and had to kind of run back into it at half strength. We saw the injuries pile up. We've seen them pile up for these clubs who played in the Club World Cup. And so, are we going to see a PSG go through the gears again in the same way that they did last season? Look, I'm not ruling that out, because I think that there's so much talent within this side. But equally, I think that you're looking at them and saying this is probably not going to be quite the same, because the fatigue will set in. And there is a consequence that you pay for basically not having a rest in 20 months. And whether that will come into play by May or not, I think is a different question. So when people talk about the Champions League table, Premier League dominance, I think there are a lot of different caveats and a lot of different discussion points that you can go down. I just wanted to kind of look at it from a slightly more stepped back perspective than just analysing the games, which is obviously normally what we do on Champions League Takeaway, and just have a little bit more of a think about what it means for these clubs and where they all are. I think that you can look at it and say Arsenal and Bayern are the best two teams in Europe so far this season and in the Champions League. Fine. I think from three down to about 11, there's not loads between Real Madrid and Man City. there's not loads between, you know, Liverpool and Barcelona. I think the rest of that is a very, very concertinaed thing that's going on, that we're seeing kind of a gap break between Bayern and Arsenal and everyone else. Now, that doesn't mean that one of Arsenal or Bayern is going to win this competition. That's kind of the beauty of the knockout stages of the Champions League. But I think we can take the fact that they have been the best two teams in the tournament so far seriously on the fact that they are 1 and 2, in the same way that Liverpool were the best side in the Champions League stage last year, right? Like, and they had the results to prove it. Those 7 wins from 7. Yeah, they lost the last game, but it was a heavily rotated side and they'd already sewn it up. You know, it was done and dusted by that point. It didn't mean that Liverpool went on and won the competition, but it did mean that they were the best side at that point. And so that's what I kind of get to with this. And I find it interesting that whilst the fact that they have, yes, the monetary advantage, but also the fact that it is such a slog in the Premier League week in, week out, I think that benefits the teams in the Premier League at this point in the season, whether it benefits them going forward when we get to a point of March and every single one of those games is starting to take its toll, and the teams who played in the Club World Cup even more so, is maybe a different question that we're going to consider when it comes to that part of the season. But I just wanted to dig into it a little bit for you today. And with that, I'm going to call things a day here on Champions League Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening as ever. Apologies for the delay on this episode, but it did allow us to look back in a slightly different way. So I'm glad we got to kind of examine it all before we get to match day 8, which is going to be absolute chaos next Wednesday. So thank you all for listening, Rank Squad. Wish you all wonderful, wonderful weekends, whatever you are doing, and we'll see you all very, very shortly. Take it easy. Peace.